WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is committed to helping you understand the truth behind the news. Now, here's your host, Paul Dragoo.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today's Thursday, May 11th, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. Treason and bribery are two of the crimes listed in Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution as grounds for impeachment and removal from office. So, have we finally reached impeachment-level treachery? The latest congressional revelations have flung wide open the floodgates of a torrent of evidence on Biden family corruption, bribery, and betrayal. Yesterday, House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer released results from an investigation that's still in its early stages.
Thank you all for coming today. Since taking the gavel in January, the Committee on Oversight and Accountability has accelerated its investigation of the Biden family's domestic and international business practices that we began last Congress. I want to be clear. This committee is investigating President Biden and his family's shady business deals that capitalize on Joe Biden's public office and risked our country's national security. This committee has a duty to ask questions and pursue the facts no matter where they take us. Through the committee's investigation, we intend to provide transparency to the American people and reach legislative solutions. In only 4 months since obtaining subpoena authority, we have made astonishing progress. Today, we'll talk about that progress. First, we want to discuss information the committee has learned since our last press conference in November. New information investigators have uncovered regarding the transfer of money from foreign entities to the Biden family. Many of the wire payments occurred while Joe Biden was vice president and leading the United States efforts in these countries.
The evidence of corruption already uncovered is massive. For example, there's money that flowed in the Biden family's shell corporations from a Romanian real estate tycoon named Gabriel Popoviciu. Ironically, in 2014 and 2015, VP Biden met with Romanian leaders to supposedly address corruption in that country.
First instance, while Vice President Biden was lecturing Romania on anti-corruption policies, in reality, he was a walking billboard for his son and family to collect money. Hunter Biden and his associates capitalized on a lucrative financial relationship with a Romanian national who was under investigation for and later convicted of corruption in Romania. The Bidens received over $1 million for the deal. And 16 of the 17 payments to their associates' account that funneled the Bidens' money occurred while Joe Biden was vice president. In fact, the money stops flowing from the Romanian national soon after Joe Biden leaves the vice presidency. This is a pattern of influence peddling.
The Bidens' dealings with communist China, likely America's number one foreign adversary, are more ominous.
We'll also provide further information regarding the Bidens' relationship with China. This includes two individuals the committee is particularly concerned about. One of them, Yu Jianming, had close ties to the highest levels of the Chinese Communist Party and operated a multi-billion dollar energy company with access to large sums of money. We'll discuss how the Bidens received millions of dollars from this individual through the use of shell companies and wire transfers.
Millions of dollars have poured into a bewildering number of LLCs set up by the Biden family. This includes a $24 million wire transfer from Ya Jianming, a high official connected with the People's Liberation Army. Ya and other Chinese national, Gong Wendong, also named in the Oversight Committee's latest memo, were both connected to the Chinese energy company CEFC, with whom Hunter Biden had extensive dealings. In many documented instances, piles of money were sent to Biden associates from Chinese sources, who would then transfer smaller incremental payments into Biden bank accounts, probably to hide where the money was coming from and how large the total payments actually were. At the very minimum, the committee's investigation has shown that President Biden's claims that he's never been involved with Hunter's business dealings, and Hunter's that he's never received money for his work with the Chinese company CEFC are false. Thousands of pages of bank records and other statements already overwhelmingly show that Joe Biden, while serving as vice president, was involved in a wide array of bribery and influence peddling activities with foreign regimes, including at least one that is an enemy of the U.S. This corruption is similar to the Chinagate scandal involving Bill Clinton. Chinagate contributed to the push for Clinton's impeachment. It's hard to imagine a scenario in which President Biden doesn't face impeachment if evidence like this continues to come out. Also on the Biden corruption front, the FBI is refusing to comply with a House Oversight Committee subpoena. The subpoena is for an alleged unclassified document that gives a detailed account of influence peddling involving then Vice President Joe Biden and a foreign national. The document, an FD 1023 form, gives a precise description of how money was paid to Biden in exchange for favorable policy decisions. The FBI, in its refusal to comply with the House committee request, cited executive branch confidentiality interests. House Oversight Committee Chairman Comer drew the obvious conclusion, telling Fox that it is clear from the FBI's response that the unclassified record the Oversight Committee subpoenaed exists, but they are refusing to provide it to the committee. The FBI's position is trust, but you aren't allowed to verify. That's unacceptable. We plan to follow up with the FBI and expect compliance with the subpoena. Here's Comer discussing the FBI stonewalling with Fox's Maria Bartiromo.
The FBI is refusing to hand over that document that you subpoenaed. It allegedly proves that President Biden was involved in an illegal bribery scheme with a foreign national. In a letter to you, the agency writes this. It wants to, quote, avoid revealing information, including unverified or incomplete information that could harm investigations, unfairly violate privacy, or create misimpressions in the public. So what are you going to do now?
Well, we've got a plan B. Unfortunately, Senator Grassley and I feared that the FBI would continue to cover this up. You know, not only did we ask for a copy of the form, we also asked what exactly they did to verify whether that claim was accurate or not, because we know there's a form, okay? There's no question there was a form. And the FBI didn't deny that they had the form, which was the one smart thing the FBI didn't do. The question that we had for the FBI is, what have you done to investigate this? So obviously they continue a pattern of protecting the Bidens, not talking about the Biden. And we're going to move forward with Plan B, and it's unfortunate that we have to do this. It's unfortunate that neither Senator Grassley nor I have 1 ounce of confidence in the leadership of the FBI right now or the DOJ, but we're going to move forward. They're not going to obstruct our investigation of corruption in this White House, and we're going to continue to press and get answers and provide the American people with the facts.
And we're going to continue our tragic theme of corruption at the highest levels here. The House Judiciary and House Intelligence Committees have discovered that the CIA may have helped gather signatories for the letter signed by 51 former national security officials to discredit the Hunter Biden laptop as Russian disinformation ahead of the 2020 presidential election. The House Judiciary Committee, its subcommittee on the weaponization of the federal government, and the House Intelligence Committee are set to release a report titled The Hunter Biden Statement, How Senior Intelligence Community Officials and the Biden Campaign Work to Mislead American Voters. The committees have been investigating how those former intelligence officials came together and got involved in the presidential campaign. The report says the letter was a political operation to help get Biden elected, and it claims that the Biden campaign took active measures to discredit the allegations about Hunter Biden by exploiting the national security credentials of former intelligence officials. The report includes testimony and communications between former intelligence officials like CIA Deputy Director Michael Morell, who worked to write the statement and get support from ex-intelligence officials. The officials who signed onto the letter included former Obama CIA Director John Brennan, former Obama Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, and former CIA Director and Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, among others. 3 days after the letter went public, candidate Biden used it against Trump's criticism. Let's take a short blast of the past to remind us how the media peddled this propaganda.
And you're making this one of the hottest, most important issues in your rallies.
It's a very important issue to find out whether or not a man's corrupt who's running for president, who's accepted money from China and from Ukraine and from Russia.
All these
yeah, I think that's
have
an important
been investigated
issue.
And misfit.
It's incredible. Excuse me, they found the laptop. Leslie, Leslie.
Can't be verified.
What can't be verified?
The laptop.
Why do you say that?
The intelligence community warned the Trump White House, and apparently, according to the Post and the Times, the National Security Advisor warned the president personally out loud that what Giuliani was bringing home about Biden was a Russian op. Despite those warnings, the president, regardless, is promoting it.
Joining me to discuss today's stories is executive senior editor of The New American, Steve Bonta. Where do we begin, Steve?
Well, this is becoming eerily reminiscent of the Clinton years, for sure. I mean, we kind of mentioned the ChinaGate scandal, just to refresh viewers' memories. I mean, that was the forgotten part of the Clinton impeachment. So originally there were, if memory serves, three articles of impeachment that were considered by the House. And only one of them ended up being voted on and being approved and sent to the Senate. So that was the one that had to do with the perjury regarding mm-hmm. the Monica Lewinsky affair. Okay, but the other two had to do with the fact that the Clintons, through a network of foreign friends like the Riyadi, the Chinese Indonesian family, the Riyadis, had been in effect sending money overseas and well, the same kind of thing, influence peddling. Apparently, they authorized the release of technology that allowed the Chinese to begin constructing working ICBMs, specifically gimbal technology, which are little devices inside missiles and rockets that prevent them from tipping over in flight, okay, that micromanage, so to speak, the trajectory of a thing. And so prior to that time, the Chinese knew how to build nuclear weapons, but they had no capacity to deliver them to the United States. Mm-hmm. And thanks to the Clintons, basically they got money for the 1996 reelection campaign from various shady Chinese sources. And it's pretty clear that there was a quid pro quo. And all of this, you know, at the time in the 90s, this was considered this is so horrible. You know, it can't be true.
Yeah.
You know, because if it's true, it implies that the president has committed treasonous actions.
Yeah.
Okay, well, of course, it was true. And this was well documented at the time, but it was, you know, airbrushed out of the picture by the compliant press. You know, fast forward a couple of generations. I mean, I guess we're two generations on from the 90s now. And, you know, I think thanks to the internet and the fact that a lot more people see things a lot more clearly, these stories actually have currency. And we're seeing, you know, it's kind of similar stuff where the Bidens have taken up where the Clinton crime syndicate left off. The only thing is they don't have quite the spectacular body trail yet. I mean, I don't know if you remember.
You keep saying that.
Yeah. I mean, back in the 90s, the Clinton body count, and of course, the mainstream media discredited that as well. And so the same thing is going on now. Everything that we've talked about today is being routinely ignored, downplayed, discredited, and poo-pooed by the likes of CNN, the New York Times, MSNBC, you name them, you know, the whole roster of the legacy media.
Yeah, we had that clip there at the end.
They haven't changed. I mean, after yesterday's the press conference that we had some clips from with Comer, the New York Times immediately ran a story saying, well, the Republicans have shown that they have no evidence whatsoever. I mean, they inhabit a completely alternate reality, you know, where the Republicans are coming out, they're showing clear evidence, paper trail, and we should say that they're only just starting. They apparently have acquired records bank statements, from 12 different banks.
Yeah.
And yesterday's report was reflective of the first four, among which were HSBC and Cathay Bank, which are two huge international banks headquartered in Hong Kong, and which, surprisingly, were very forthcoming when Congress said when they subpoenaed them and said we want these statements. They didn't stonewall at all. And so probably because, you know, Hong Kong still had, you know, the banking community in Hong Kong still wants access to all that international moolah.
Yeah.
And they're afraid, you know, of the consequences if they should, you know, try to cover it, particularly given the current political climate between China and the United States. Anyway, it's very complicated. But they got those records. And so what we're seeing, there are still eight sets of bank statements, bank records to go through. in addition to lots of other stuff. And from this alone, they have established that the Bidens created more than 20 LLCs.
Wow.
Okay, and just to give some, and of course, well, one of the other narratives that's been promoted for several years now by the mainstream media, including Leslie Stahl and other people as well, you know, yes, we know the Bidens were involved, but he didn't do this when he was vice president, so therefore there was no criminality.
Wow.
Well, now they've proven that that's not true.
Yes.
And this is one of the points that Comer made, okay?
Yeah. Can you imagine, though, what would happen if we were to do this kind of digging into other legislators and politicians? Obviously, they did this kind of digging because he's the president, but this was happening while he was vice president. What would we uncover with so many others?
Well, it's impossible to know. Obviously, you know, the corruption in D.C. has always been epic, and it becomes more and more so as the size and power and scope and cost of the federal government becomes greater and greater. See, this is something that people don't understand. You know, people who think that by giving the government new competency over something like, let's say, your retirement funds. So you go, bing, presto, change-o, we have Social Security. Oh, well, let's put government in charge of health care because there are problems there. Well, now we have Medicare, Medicaid, you know, Obamacare, and all of
There's
this
so
seems—
There's so much fraud in
Well,
that
all
too.
Of it seems benevolent. But what you do is you create a much, much more powerful institution, benevolent or no, and it ends up being not benevolent because the more powerful it becomes, the more it attracts people like the Bidens. The more it becomes a magnet for people who crave power above all else. And so, you know, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of people like this. The Bidens, like the Clintons before them and the Clintons still, are probably exceptionally corrupt, even by D.C. standards. That would be my surmise. But, you know, just to circle back, I mean, the Romanian part of this, which, you know, you coming from Romania maybe has some interest.
I'm surprised it didn't pop up earlier.
Yes, well, yeah, I mean,
we were already in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, I don't know that Romania, I mean, is a particular enemy of the United States.
It's
I mean,
not,
you know,
no.
they're just another kind of a corrupt,
run-of-the-mill corrupt
Eastern
country,
European
yeah,
country.
Yeah,
sure,
of course.
But the interesting and the amount of money involved there was only about $1 million. Okay, which seems to be kind of a drop in the pond compared to.
Yeah.
I mean, and they're never going to uncover all of it. I mean, no doubt, an investigation like this can't uncover all of it because the Biden family is worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and they didn't get that from you know, Jill Biden's teaching gig or Joe Biden's political salary as a senator and vice president and so forth and so on. You know, so there's a lot more than $10 million or even $50 million at stake, no doubt. So this is the tip of the iceberg. But here's the point. Even with the Romanian thing, okay, there were 17 different transfers of money from this guy. What was his name?
Popoviciu.
Yeah, Popoviciu in Romania. And he's apparently some sort of a real estate tycoon over there. Anyway, of those 17, 16 occurred while Biden was vice president. And that's just the relatively insignificant Romanian portion of this.
Yeah.
Who knows how the Chinese part and the Russian part yet to be uncovered, the Ukrainian part, and who knows what other rogue regimes are involved in all of this.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Well, I guess the good news is that we're covering this. The bad news is that who knows what else we're going to find out. Well, stay tuned, folks, because we'll be right back to discuss the rest of our stories.
You remember when everyone bought all the toilet paper? And they wanted me to wear these things? And someone invested a lot of money into this stuff. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
Being informed is important, but being informed with the truth is essential. Visit thenewamerican.com for news you can trust.
You remember when everyone bought all the toilet paper? And they wanted me to wear these things? And someone invested a lot of money into this stuff. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
Being informed is important, but being informed with the truth is essential. Visit thenewamerican.com for news you can trust.
Welcome back. Title 42, the Trump-era COVID restriction that has helped stymie the already wide tide of illegals, has been in the news a lot lately, and for good reason. When it expires tonight at 11:59 Eastern Time, illegal immigration across our southern border is expected to explode. No one knows for sure how big that surge will be, but if what happened Tuesday is any indication, the word invasion will be undeniably applicable. Border Patrol caught more than 11,000 migrants crossing the southern border on Tuesday, ABC reported. That's a record number of apprehensions in one day, higher than the 10,000 per day predicted by Department of Homeland Security officials. One DHS official said to NBC News that, quote, "We're already breaking and we haven't hit the starting line," end quote. In March, there were more than 5,000 illegal alien encounters per day along our southern border, according to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency. And as we've mentioned, there has already been an increase since many who want to cross the border illegally haven't waited for tonight's ending of Title 42. If the post-Title 42 influx turns out to be 10,000 or more per day, and if that rate continues for a year, that would mean that 3.65 million illegal alien encounters per year. And that would far exceed the record-breaking 2.76 million encounters in fiscal year 2022. The Biden administration, whose policies have fostered more illegal migration, announced a new policy yesterday. In a news conference, Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas said this.
As you can see by the images before us of removal flights and encounters with our Border Patrol agents, we are making it very clear that our border is not open, that crossing irregularly is against the law, and that those who are not eligible for relief will be quickly returned. Do not listen to the lies of the smugglers. This is what will happen to you. You will be returned. Today, alongside the Department of Justice, we are finalizing a new rule to encourage individuals to use available, lawful, safe, and orderly pathways to enter the United States. The rule presumes that those who do not use lawful pathways to enter the United States are ineligible for asylum.
Regarding the new rule, CBS News opined, the rule also represents a major pivot by President Biden, a Democrat who campaigned on restoring access to the U.S. asylum system, contrary to Trump administration rules that made it more difficult for migrants to secure refuge on American soil. In fact, the regulation published Wednesday resembles a Trump-era policy struck down in federal court that Biden decried in 2020. Wow, Steve. Apparently, the borders are not open, regardless of what all those millions have thought and all those millions who've come in. What do you make about this new policy that apparently is like what Trump tried to implement?
Well, first of all, someone needs to explain to me why Title 42 expires at 11:59 and not at midnight. That doesn't make sense to me. I mean, that's a whole extra minute. It seems very arbitrary. But anyway.
You think they'll respect that?
I don't know.
Okay, guys.
The border policing under Mayorkas and Biden and this clown cavalcade masquerading as an actual administration, sort of reminiscent of that opening scene in Men in Black, you know, Tommy Lee Jones, Agent Z, you know, welcoming all the illegal alien Mexicans across the border, overruling the border agents who are trying to, you know, to round them up and going after that one guy, you know, Mikey, the alien criminal who's from, you know, another planet, that type of alien. Yeah. And I'm sort of wondering, maybe that's what the Biden administration's up to. Maybe they're only concerned about interplanetary illegal aliens. They've been co-opted by the Men in Black or something.
I don't
know what to think. It's so irrational. And this shows, again, you know, the comments that you ran just now from faux Secretary Mayorkas show that this man is either absolutely a pathological liar or he's living in an alternate reality or both. I mean, while, you know, perhaps some of the reports are a little bit exaggerated, you know, the video of tens of thousands of people streaming unimpeded across the Rio Grande and the deserts of Arizona into the United States, you know, it doesn't lie.
Yeah,
I think they're counting
on people not finding out. perhaps by, you know, if because if you watch certain news broadcasts, I suppose, and certain news stations, they don't exactly show all of that, right? They don't. I mean, ABC apparently did here, and there was some video there and whatnot. But like you said, they're either pathological liars or they're totally disconnected from reality. But I mean, DHS has made comments, statements repeatedly, and the numbers don't lie, right? So it's like, unless he's saying now that the game has changed, now we got this new policy, don't come over here, now we're done, you know?
But we know that won't happen, okay? It won't happen as long as Biden's in office. It's very clear. And of course, this has been what I'm about to say has also been branded far right, you know, conspiracy theory. But it's very clear that they're doing this to change not technically the demographics. It's not a racial issue per se. It's they want to change the electoral graphics. And they know that, you know, most of these folks who are coming in, if they show them benevolence and release them into the general populace, which they've been doing now for the last, you know, 2 years, mm-hmm. That ultimately, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of our lives, they and their children will vote Democratic in perpetuum. And not just vote Democratic, they will support the whole range of big government conceits that the Democrats stand for.
That'll be hilarious if that backfires on them, because we're already seeing Latinos saying, we want nothing to do with this, you know, madness, this culture madness that you guys are bringing. I think it's only a matter of time before they might wake up too. We're already seeing that. Anyway, that's my take on it. All right, thanks, Steve. So that's all for our news segment today. Tomorrow, we're showing a documentary we produced on the border chaos called Out of Control. We produced the movie many years ago, but it's eerily relevant today. So for more truth behind the news, make sure to get a subscription to The New American Magazine. You can do so online at thenewamerican.com, or you can call our office at 800-727-8783, Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. And stay tuned, because after this, I'm interviewing Freedom Project Academy Director Dr. Duke Pesta. We'll be gabbing about education, culture, and likely giving you more reasons to get your kids out of government schools. We'll be right back.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence proclaims God-given rights, and we intend to protect them. Working with people like you for over 50 years, preserving freedom and building a better tomorrow. Safeguarding the Constitution by limiting government power. We are restoring liberties, educating voters, and leading the freedom movement. Join with us. United, we will defend our rights. We are all Americans. We are the John Birch Society.
Welcome back. I'm joined by Dr. Duke Pesta, who is the director of Freedom Project Academy. He's also the host of the Dr. Duke Show, and he is a tenured professor at the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. Dr. Duke is an authority on education and culture. Welcome back, Duke.
Thanks, Paul. How are you doing today?
Good, good. I love having you here, and I love talking to you, but you seldom bring good news, and I have a feeling that's what's going to happen today. So what do you got for us today?
Well, when you cover education, the news is almost never good. I mean, when you think about the monopoly that the progressives have on education in this country from preschool all the way through graduate and law school. So there's not much to report that's good. I do want to talk about Joe Biden last week, week and a half ago anyway. He came out at a press conference, which he almost never does anymore, and he made the following statement, quote, "There's no such thing as someone else's child. No such thing as someone else's child. Our nation's children are all our children."
Yeah, that takes a village outlook there, huh?
You remember Hillary Clinton making that statement?
Yeah.
And it's really interesting when you think about that, because Chelsea Clinton, go back to her mother Hillary, who said that back in the 90s. Hillary Clinton also made the Chelsea, her daughter, made the observation just 2 days ago that she's got $18 million in donors And she wants a program that she's trying to push that will require every newborn baby in the country to be vaccinated for COVID, whether or not parents agree. So what the theme of our time together.
There's a clause in there?
Yeah.
For
that's what that's what she wants. That's the whole movement. It's a booster movement. It's the whole purpose of this money is to force every kid in this country to be vaccinated, whether the parents want it or not. Yeah. And you've got big money behind this, the Gates people and all kinds of those. Yeah, you can imagine. So the theme for today, Paul, is going to be, all right, let's take them at their word for a second. If indeed our kids belong to them, then the fact that they're not giving our kids an education should require them to pay us back our tax money. But of course, that's not what they mean. So I want to give you another story here that's related to this. And this one is kind of a, when you think about how, if our kids belong to government, how does our government treat them? Well, just take a visit to Colorado. Mm-hmm. And Colorado, pretty stunning. 27 congressmen, state congressmen, voted against a bill that would make it a felony for adults to show their private parts to little kids. Now, this strikes me as a no-brainer. There's already laws on the book in Colorado that makes it a serious misdemeanor. But bumping this up a little bit, you ask yourself, okay, if our kids belong to government, including the government of the state of Colorado, and if you live in Colorado, why would they not want to protect our kids? You and I would protect our kids. We would want to see greater penalties for adults who were, you know, exposing themselves to little kids. And so here's the reason that happened. So this was Colorado House of Representatives voted on HB 23-1135. It was a bill that was introduced to increase the severity of indecent exposure in front of minors to a class 6 felony, and 27 Democrats voted against the bill, one of them saying, quote, she was concerned it would lead to the ban of drag shows.
At schools.
At schools and public libraries. Yeah. So what we're learning now, our kids belong to government, and government is more concerned about drag queens perhaps exposing them and not allowing that to happen than they are what our kids see.
Yeah, yeah. So we definitely don't want government taking care.
This is what happens
of our kids. This is just crazy. Again, I feel like I say this every time I talk to you, and it is. Now, what ultimately happened to the law? I get because the Democrats over there have control.
Yeah, they do, and so nothing's happening with it. They filibustered for hours and hours and hours, and so the whole thing is kind of in limbo.
Yeah.
And, you know, let's go a little bit further. Okay, if the federal government owns our kids, you also remember what happened about 2 years ago, two and a half weeks ago, when in the Congress of the United States Senate, United States Congress, every single Democrat voted against protecting women.
Yeah, yeah.
And we talked about it, I think, a little bit last
that
week.
A couple weeks.
Yeah, I want to drag that back here. Yeah. So, because this is the angle, right? So, theoretically, then the government isn't responsible for our kids and our daughters in particular, right? Their protection. But not a single Democrat who are a minority party in the House, with 219 Republicans, 203 Democrats. Think about that. 203 Democrats want men in girl showers, bathrooms, right, playing sports alongside of these girls. So when you think about when they tell you, you've heard this before, right? When they tell you who they are, you listen. And what they've told us is your kids are our kids, and we're going to force boys and men around, naked men around your kids. We're going to vote against bills that would punish men for exposing themselves to little kids. We will support men being naked around your kids, whether you like it or not.
Yeah. I don't understand how the schools are still have the enrollment they do. We know that they've been bleeding enrollment, and I believe, you know, Freedom Project has been has gained from some of that, and we should gain more, quite frankly. But what's taking – you told me off air that you had testified in the Wisconsin State Capitol, right? And what is your feeling when you run into Democrats, even in state politics? Are they all brainwashed and tribal about this insanity like, you know, the federal legislators are?
Yeah, well, I testified – but there was a assembly committee on colleges and universities.
Yeah.
And so they did a listening tour. They went to three or four different colleges. They came to mine, UW-Oshkosh, last week. So a week ago on Wednesday, I testified for about an hour.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting. You had on the one side of the table, you had all the Democrat representatives, and on the other side, you had the Republicans. By the time I was done with my testimony, which was pretty frank, pretty direct about what was happening, about how free speech rights, diversity worldview were being completely undermined by the progressives around universities. Well, the Republicans were quite pleased, right? Because that was the premise. I helped them prove that premise. Mm-hmm. But the Democrats, they wanted no part of this. They wouldn't even look at me. They just kept looking away. I hope that means that they couldn't answer. They were unable to argue.
You hope they hung their head in shame,
they
huh?
They didn't want any part of it. And, you know, some of it has to do with the fact that I was begging them. I really wanted them to come challenge me because I've been a professor for 30 years. Other professors testified. I had a student, a former student of mine, was sitting next to me, African-American young woman, who testified that she had been victimized by progressives for not being progressive enough.
Yeah,
and so that really kind of shook them up too. But that doesn't mean they're going to change their votes. All that means is they kept their mouth shut. They weren't going to argue with me, and they were certainly not going to argue with a young African-American woman. So they kept their mouth shut, and when they get back to the assembly, I'm sure they're going to completely vote against any move that the legislature could make to make it freer for people to speak and think what they want on college campuses.
And on college campuses, is there this silence again? This is where the connection comes from. I guess it's like we recognize, and here at the JBS and Freedom Project and the TNA, we recognize what insanity is, and we speak very liberally about it and things like that. But that's not necessarily the case. There are repercussions on college campuses when you say, hey, it's not okay for a dude who dresses like a woman to expose himself to little kids. Like there's some backlash when they behave like that.
The universities are so monolithically progressive, overwhelmingly, that, you know, there are very few conservatives on college campuses.
Yes.
You're not going to find many of me. I'm a very, very, very small.
You're a unicorn.
Very much. I mean, a conservative Christian who is willing to speak to those issues. I've met some conservatives, but they keep their mouths shut, right? They're very careful.
Well, that's the problem too, right?
It is. It is. I mean, now, again, there's not many of them. So, I mean, I have been targeted for being what I am multiple times, and nobody wants that.
Yeah, and they see what happens to you, huh?
Yeah, but there's so few of them. I mean, it's not like if every one of them stood up and started speaking, they'd pay any attention.
Yeah.
What we're finding, Paul, is that the people who are getting punished the most are moderate Democrats, those old-fashioned liberal Democrats. And you remember them, right? They were Democrat, but they believed in borders. They believed in free speech.
Mm-hmm.
Gun
rights.
The Constitution they stood behind. Many of them were pro-life. Remember, just 20 years ago, those creatures existed.
Yeah. Well, they believed that marriage was between a man and
absolutely.
A woman. What, like 10 years ago?
Yeah, that's right. And so now, it's those moderate Democrats, people who are on the left but not progressively left, not crazy left.
Yeah.
Those are the teachers, the professors who are getting – and the kids who are getting rolled over, because there's a lot of them. There are a lot of Democrats, a lot of liberals who don't quite share the cuckoo-ness of the radical left. So on college campuses, they're being treated like as if they were – they may as well be me, according to the powers that be. To not be radical left is to be a conservative.
Yeah.
So those are the ones who are getting mostly persecuted.
Are you seeing a fracturing in the Democrat Party, the national and even in state parties? Are you seeing a fracturing between those Democrats?
No. But the same thing that's happened to me and people like me, those conservatives, Republicans, they keep their mouths shut. They conform. They quietly conform. They try to be not as left as their colleagues, but they conform. So what's happening now is those moderate Democrats now are tacitly becoming progressives. In other words, they're not fighting the progressive movement. They are hiding from it. They are trying to be in its good graces. Maybe when they close the door to their classroom and teach, maybe they're a little less over the top. Maybe they're a little more tolerant.
Mm-hmm.
But once you get outside that classroom, the liberals, they bite their lip. And then, you know, we should also point out that the modern middle of the road, so to speak, Democrat liberal still has way more in common with the progressive left than they have with us, right? So we're still the problem. I think that's how they accommodate it in their minds. Yeah, well, I don't believe in all the left stuff. I do believe in free speech, yada yada. But let's face it, Republicans and conservatives are the real problem, and we can agree on that, so they go along with it. But, you know, whenever a kid reports them for being not liberal enough, they find out that they're not going to be spared just because they voted for Joe Biden.
Yeah, yeah. Well, my goodness, Duke. And this is perhaps part of the problem why we are here is because, those who know it's wrong or who oppose it, but instead of speaking out, they would rather just kind of go along. They don't want the resistance. And I'm sure there's some universal law that, explains that. You know, most people would not rather encounter obstacles and resistance and bullying and things like that. But would you agree that that's part of how we got here is because the people who knew better, everyone just kind of, well, somebody else will do it, or sure, we'll just go along.
Sure. And the people who speak the loudest on campuses they suck up all the oxygen.
Yeah.
The administrators. Well, if you're a college dean or a president or you're not afraid of the conservative right on college campuses. The more you persecute conservatives, yeah, the more everybody else is going to applaud you. But they also have figured out, the administrators, that it's only the 10% that make the most noise, the radical progressive socialists, yeah, the teachers and the students. They're the ones that are going to cancel you. They're the ones that are going to march into your office. They're the ones that are going to shut down speech around campus. And they realize that unless that group is happy, their jobs also are in danger. So they surrender.
You got to give it to them. They know about organizing.
Yeah, absolutely.
They have for such a long time. I mean, I'm not a history major or anything like that, but you can look back just even 100 years ago when the socialists were organizing in the 1910s and the 1920s, and they made it look like they had this all the support and, eventually got quashed and whatnot. But they always known how to apply pressure in the right places. And it sounds like it's working on college.
Well,
they terrify.
It's Alinskyite, right? Right? It's the manual, the rules for radicals.
Mm-hmm.
You mock, you target, you isolate.
Yes.
I mean, it works, and it would work just as well for conservatives. The problem is that it's evil.
Yeah.
In order to get the kind of power the progressive left has, you have to lie about people. You have to be a hypocrite.
Yeah.
What you do is good, but when your enemy does it, you're a monster.
Yeah.
You have to use sarcasm and mocking, not logical reasons. And you can look. I'm not saying that conservatives and Republicans are the most morally pure people, but most of us don't want to cheat to get ahead.
Yeah.
Most of us don't want to destroy people to get our ideas across. The progressive left, and this goes right to its Soviet and communist Marxist roots, that they know that that's how you bully people into submission.
Yeah, yeah. And for them, the ends always justify the means. And we differ so greatly in that. And there's got to be a moral, ethical way to win. I mean, speaking of mocking, Tucker Carlson announced recently that he's coming back. I think he did a great job of mocking the left. I don't think what he did was necessarily evil. I think it was mean at times, and I wouldn't necessarily subscribe to it. But they can't stand to be mocked.
Well, the beginning of the Screwtape Letters, C.S. Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
He starts with two quotes. One is from Martin Luther, and the other one is from St. Thomas More, and they were, of course, enemies. One was moving the Protestant Reformation forward, and, of course, More was defending it, but they both said the same thing. The devil, that proud spirit, cannot stand to be mocked.
Yeah.
That the devil himself can tolerate everything except being mocked. Nobody, even the devil, likes to be ridiculed. It works. Ridicule works. And this also raises another philosophical question. If they're so good at mocking us and it's getting them votes and power, if that's the only way to get some of it back, Tucker figured that out. And another guy who did it was Rush Limbaugh. He very, very cleverly satirized the left. And look what happened.
But they make it so easy now.
Well, they do, right. Everything they do is mockable, right?
Yeah. It's so ridiculous now. I mean, we report the news here at the New American, and there's quite, when we're writing these scripts and things like that, we just can't help because it just oozes out because it's so easy. But unfortunately, it's so tragic.
Yeah.
There's so much tragedy that comes with it. And I would love to see these interviews and these conversations we have 10 years from now and laugh and say, man, I am so glad we got over that phase. Do you think with the 45 seconds that we have left that there's a way to come back from this?
I would say this. This is how bad it is. Saturday Night Live, who lives to make fun of people, will not make fun of Joe Biden. He's the most mockable president we've had since Gerald Ford.
Good point.
Right? And the fact that the leftist SNL won't mock him tells you that the progressive left doesn't like to be mocked either, which makes me wonder, maybe we should be doing more of it.
Maybe we should make fun of him more.
Yeah.
Good point, Duke. Good point. And let's leave it at that. And thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for all the work you do. And for those of you watching, if you're looking for a private education for your child, look up Freedom Project Academy. Is it FPA.com?
FPEUSA.org.
There you go. FPEUSA.org. And we will see you after the break.
All right, parents, listen up. We've all seen the countless examples of how radical leftists have been destroying American schools. It's no longer just about the terrible math and reading levels. Now radical left teachers birthed from liberal universities are forcing gender indoctrination in kindergarten. They're teaching lessons on white guilt.
Freedom Project Academy has perfected live online learning over the course of a decade. I get a ton of great feedback about this program, a ton.
They're built on Judeo-Christian values, a classical curriculum. What does that mean? It means they're taught, your children are taught the way that the founding generations of the country. My own son, Noah, did Freedom Project Academy for several years when he was younger.
The more we tell our friends about these things, the more people will get on board. And I believe that we can be the catalyst to some real change.
We must save the West. Our way of life and our culture is under attack. And because of patriots like you and your project, I have optimism for the future.
And now, we're going to cap off the show with members of the John Birch Society's research and legislative team discussing the latest legislative updates.
This is Peter Eichowski with The New American. Today we'll be talking about a very important topic, the USMCA trade agreement, which covers the United States, Mexico, and Canada, and really why it's a very dangerous threat to our national sovereignty. So joining me to talk about this topic is Christian Gomez, the research project manager of the John Birch Society. So thanks for being on, Christian.
Well, thank you for having me on today. It's a pleasure.
So in 2016, presidential candidate Donald Trump promised that he would withdraw the United States from NAFTA and end that trade agreement. But then in 2017, the year after he was elected, the Trump administration said that they would renegotiate NAFTA. And that led to the USMCA trade agreement. So what is the USMCA? And then is it really a new agreement? And also, is it a good deal for the United States?
Okay, those are all really good questions. Well, the USMCA, as you said, stands for United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement. And like you pointed out, he didn't get rid of NAFTA. Rather, they renegotiated NAFTA. In fact, during the development stages of the USMCA, before they came up with that name, at least for the U.S., because Mexico and Canada have different names for it officially, but when they before they came up with the names that they did for all three countries, the working title was NAFTA 2018 as they were drafting it throughout the year. And at one point, that even leaked, and that was kind of a news story. Oh, I thought that you were getting rid of NAFTA. Why is it still called NAFTA as a working file? So that was pretty interesting before the agreement was publicly released. Now, as for what the agreement ultimately does, I believe your question was something to that effect. So the agreement, it's not really a new agreement. What's only new is perhaps the name of it. There was a study done in Canada, and of course we wrote about this at the New American. There's an article about it on thenewamerican.com. How about 50% or so, I forget the number off the top of my head, but about 50% of the agreement, over 50% actually, it was over 50%. I think it was 55% of the text of the USMCA was taken copy-pasted from the TPP. In fact, I remember the very night, in the wee hours in the morning, when the document was put up on the website of the United States Trade Representative Office, the USTR website, ustr.gov, when they first released that text for the USMCA, I was looking through the different chapters, and what caught my attention right away was how it read almost exactly in many paragraphs, almost word for word, to what was in the old Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, the TPP, that the Obama administration and his USTR, Michael Froman, was working on during his administration. In fact, Michael Froman, who was the main trade representative under Obama, and Robert Lighthizer, Trump's main trade representative, who was the lead negotiator for the U.S. for the USMCA, both of these people, Froman and Lighthizer, work for the same organization, the Council on Foreign Relations. They are members of the Council on Foreign Relations. And it's interesting how both agreements read so similar to each other. So they're extremely compatible. So even though Trump campaigned on, we're going to not get in the TPP that Obama negotiated, and we're going to get rid of NAFTA, and he called both of them the worst trade agreements ever, he ends up creating something that's a merger of NAFTA and TPP. And you could describe USMCA as NAFTA updated to the standards and wording of the TPP. So even though we are not part of the TPP now, the USMCA brings us in line with those other global regional agreements.
Yeah, and very recently there were a couple of developments in terms of some of the railway companies operating in the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. So there was the merger of Canadian Pacific and Kansas City Southern, and then there were three other railway companies that recently announced that they would begin cooperating with each other. Can you tell us about that, and how does this tie into the effort to create a North American union?
Yeah, I'll try to be brief about this. So, as you mentioned, Kansas City Railroad Company and the other Canadian railroad company, Canadian Pacific, they merged last year, well, actually a couple of years ago, they were negotiating to merge. But this year, it was approved by U.S. regulators, the merger. So Canadian Pacific bought over Kansas City, which had in the past in itself, Kansas City had a joint venture with a Mexican railroad company, and they made Kansas City de Mexico, which was a rail line that extends from Veracruz in the Gulf Coast of Mexico. And there's also, they have a port in Lázaro Cárdenas in the Pacific Coast of Mexico, going all the way up through Mexico City, Monterrey, and into Laredo, Texas, and Brownsville, Texas. And then connecting all the way up to Kansas City with one line even going into your neck of the woods in Springfield, Illinois. But then when Canadian Pacific bought over that company and it was approved just in March of this year, now Canadian Pacific has its own, they have their own railroad company that goes from Vancouver all the way to like Maine and so forth, and covering some of the northern Midwest states. So now they have a unified rail company, and that covers all three continents, the first of its kind. And in regards to the other companies, so there's Canadian National and Grupo Mexico and Union Pacific. These are three competitors based out of, you know, those their respective three countries. And they didn't merge, but they've agreed to have a new unified rail system called Falcon Premium. They announced that towards the end of April to compete against the other one. But what both of these do, essentially, these drive a spike on the track towards a North American union. Forgive my pun, it's totally intended, but that's what they're both doing. Because if you look at the text of the USMCA, the agreement discusses the importance of streamlining the supply chains of North America and the North American economy. In fact, chapter 26 of the USMCA is the competitiveness chapter of the USMCA, and it talks a lot about how North America, as one entity, not as three separate countries, but as one economic entity, has to be competitive against other regions of the world, EU, African Union, China, etc. So under the guise of competitiveness, to compete against the EU and China, we have to unify and be a larger block. So these agreements help to streamline the process, because ultimately, if they are to, and by they I mean the globalists, regionalists, if they want to homogenize all three nations into one super state, they have to do so with the economy. And this is one area, a major area, in which they can facilitate that merger to move us in the direction of having one solidified unistate for North America.
Yeah, so we have a couple minutes left. So very briefly, can you discuss to us about the USMCA Commission and how that is a step towards a European Union-style organization.
Yeah, so the USMCA has various chapters in the agreement, and one of them is the chapter that mentions the Free Trade Commission. This is the overarching commission. I believe it's like chapter 30 or 31, one of those chapters towards the end of the agreement. It establishes the creation of this. Well, the USMCA itself creates a hierarchy of various committees. So I mentioned the Competitiveness Committee. Every chapter, more or less, almost every chapter, has its own committee that it creates for that subject, and it's all under the Free Trade Commission. Now, Europe, and I know you know quite a bit about the European Union yourself, the European Union is controlled by the European Commission, which is essentially its equivalent of the Free Trade Commission. So there is a commission for all three countries in the USMCA, and it's the body that has the power to propose even changes to the agreement. And these changes don't require the consent of Congress. They can propose and enact their own changes. But eventually, what that commission will grow into being, I foresee, is a government is a governance body for the continent. It starts out dealing specifically and narrowly with just trade dispute settlement and areas of economic concern that affect all three countries or any kind of disputes there may be. But ultimately, that body will likely grow into the body that's then used to create policies, whether they call it regulations or laws, whatever they want to call it. But it's going to effectively create transnational law for all three countries in the continent, and eventually the U.S. Congress, the Mexican Congress, Canadian Parliament will have to just rubber stamp all of these initiatives. And that's exactly what we see in Europe. So the EU Commission didn't form overnight. It gradually evolved into the super entity that it is currently, and this is what we see happening with the USMCA. It is all a quest for a North American Union, and we have an article about that in the New American as well.
Yeah, so it's really clear that the USMCA is a major threat to our national sovereignty, similar to how the European Union has really decimated the sovereignty of the European countries. So what can people do to stop a North American Union?
Glad you asked. Go to jbs.org/alerts and then click on the federal alerts and go to, we have an alert called Get Us Out of the USMCA. So I would encourage everyone to go to that alert and send a pre-written message that's there. But we want you to write the message in your own words. I mean, we have our own words there that you can use to help you, but put it in your own words, please. Read some of our articles on thenewamerican.com about these topics so you could be better educated on the subject. But put it in your own words so members of Congress can see your concern about the direction we're going into and hopefully get them to repeal the USMCA Implementation Act, and also to repeal the North American Free Trade Agreement Implementation Act. Because if we get out of the USMCA, I guess they would probably theoretically say that NAFTA then applies. So we have to make sure we're out of USMCA, NAFTA, and any kind of regional agreements that erode our national sovereignty.
Yeah, so as Christian said, we encourage everyone to go to jbs.org/alerts and then click on the alert, Get Us Out of the USMCA, to contact Congress about that. So a very important thing and a very important topic overall. So thanks for being on, Christian.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us today. And remember to visit newamerican.com for more truth behind the news. And make sure to tune in tomorrow for our documentary, Out of Control, The Immigration Invasion. We'll see you tomorrow.